This podcast series is made possible by Allens Confidential, the podcast that gives you real insight into what it's like to work at Allens Law. You can listen by searching Allens Confidential wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Footnotes, a podcast created by law students with the aim of tackling topics, issues, and questions you may have about everything and anything to do with the law. This is our first episode of the year, and we wanted to shed light on an issue that's been in the media a lot, but that most of us don't know a lot about. My name's Justin, and let's have a chat about our gun laws. Gun laws. Those two words carry a weight like none other. It's easy to associate the phrase gun laws with all that is happening in America. But what we'd like to emphasize from the very outset of this podcast is that whilst America sheds considerable light on the need for reform and on the need for change, in many respects America's gun culture is vastly different from Australia's, and very, very entrenched. We're going to focus primarily on gun laws in Australia. But that itself begs the question, why should we worry about gun laws in Australia? It seems like we solved the problem in the 1990s, and it feels like it's a non-issue for most Australians. But we'd like to pose the question to you. How much do you know about our gun laws? Let's rewind time a little bit. It may surprise you to know that there are around 3.5 million firearms both registered and unregistered in Australia following World War II, and that this was actually after handguns had been banned from personal ownership. There were no real limitations imposed on the mental or physical conditions of those applying. To understand how our laws came to be, we got in touch with Professor Philip Bulbers. He's an associate professor at the Sydney School of Public Health, is the founding director of gunpolicy.org, and was named one of the top 100 most influential people in the world on armed violence reduction by the NGO Action on Armed Violence. There has been a very recent event of a mass shooting in the United States with the Garlic Festival in Northern California. And I think it's a very kind of contemporary conversation to have. But I think that most Australians, especially people from my generation, don't actually remember events like Port Arthur in real time. And there's kind of a great separation between seeing gun violence and things that are happening in America and kind of actually having them happen in Australia at a reasonably fair rate. So, as a first question, I want you to take us back to a time in Australia when owning guns was actually quite common. Was there a sense of social unease, or was it something that was kind of more normalized and therefore needed a lot of drastic action to change?
Australia has always had quite a high rate of firearm ownership. That's because, like the United States and Canada and New Zealand, were what's known as frontier territories, we're with a lot of reasons to shoot things. We have a lot of introduced pests in both Australia and New Zealand, a lot of animals that do damage to the environment, and they need to be shot. It was just generally accepted back in the days before the 1980s and before that people who owned firearms were largely, almost exclusively, responsible people, and they had a license to own their firearm. And there was this acceptance that a person who had a firearm license and had gone through all the hoops to qualify to get a firearm license, which even before 96 were quite stringent in some states, that person was sort of automatically a good bloke because they had a license. But we don't think that way about cars, and we accept that there are plenty of law-abiding drivers who are only law-abiding until a law comes along they can't abide. And the same is true with shooters. It was extraordinarily easy to get a firearm before Port Arthur in most territories. And remember, Australia had been importing many, many guns for many years. I mean, there were years in which Australia imported 250,000 firearms. And the total gun stock in Australia was said to be around about 3.2 million before Port Arthur.
On August 9th, 1987, on what would have been a typical Sunday evening in Hoddle Street, 19-year-old Julian Knight carried three guns and went on a 45-minute shooting spree. That night, seven were killed and 19 others were wounded. Knight had been a former Australian Army cadet and had been discharged months earlier for stabbing an army officer in a Canberra nightclub. Knight was due to appear in court in November on charges of assault. This, combined with personal and financial problems, was said to trigger the horrific massacre that ensued on Hoddle Street. It was notably the ease at which Knight was able to acquire his firearms despite his troubled mental state that catalysed a wildfire of debate to spread across Australia about reforming laws on gun acquisition.
Terrible mass shooting in Australia. A young man has killed at least 30 people and wounded many more. Police have surrounded the house where he's now holding hostages today, Sunday, April 28th, 1996.
Grief and anger tonight as a nation searches for answers to the slaughter. Good evening. All Australians tonight share the horror of the Port Arthur massacre. 35 people are dead, 18 are injured. Police have now named the mass murderer. He is 28-year-old Martin Bryant, a local man believed to be intellectually handicapped.
On April 28, 1996, 29-year-old Martin Bryant killed 35 innocent people and injured at least 18 more at the Port Arthur Historic Site, a major tourist attraction in Tasmania. Using a semi-automatic weapon not required to be registered at that time, Bryant moved through the site and fired at those present for almost an hour.
Port Arthur was really only the last straw because of the scale of the tragedy. It was the most terrible event, and Australians took it very, very seriously. It was quite something to be there in those days, in the middle of it, and to see the unanimity of Australians. It was almost possible to feel sorry for gun lobbyists. The moment they popped their heads up, they got shouted down. The gun lobby was probably the least popular political lobby group in the country for several months around that time. And you have to have lived through that period to remember what a shift in public attitude it engendered. But there was another thing that was really instrumental in these laws, and that is that ever since these mass shootings began in 1987, there had been a series of 10 or 12 parliamentary inquiries, government inquiries, national inquiries, all of which had come up with almost exactly the same formula for gun control in Australia. Universal firearm registration, tighter gun licensing, proof of reason to own a firearm, which we haven't had before then. All of these inquiries had been stymied. Every single one of them was defeated by the gun lobby. The gun lobby was dictating policy on firearms in Australia for decades, and they dictated that policy right up to Port Arthur. At Port Arthur, the country snapped and said, no more, we will go no further, and that was largely what John Howard did, and he pulled all of the parties together. Everybody was agreed that something had to be done. In the filing cabinet at the Australasian Police Ministers Conference, there was one man who held all of these previous inquiries and all their previous recommendations, and he was immediately called in to John Howard's office with the Principal Private Secretary, and they realised that they had all of the solutions in a filing cabinet ready to go. And so that was what made it possible for the Australasian Police Ministers Conference to decide, only 12 days after Port Arthur, that all of these previous recommendations suddenly made sense, that all the previous inquiries should be listened to. They accepted almost verbatim every recommendation that had come out of those earlier inquiries, and that formed the National Firearms Agreement in Australia.
Now, it is important to note that though the Australian federal government only has the power to create legislation to control the movement of firearms in and out of the country, Prime Minister John Howard nonetheless moved to encourage the states and territories across Australia to enact stricter gun laws.
as a population, there was a huge attitudinal change at that point, exemplified by John Howard. John Howard was the most conservative prime minister for decades. He immediately flew, of course, to Tasmania, came back from the memorial ceremonies and the funeral, absolutely determined that, in his words, this was his mantra then and has been ever since, we will not go the American way. That's what John Howard determined, and that's what Australia largely determined. That Australia was not going to go down the American road with guns. Plenty of things to admire about America. Gun control is not one of them. And so that changed the whole national attitude.
These actions were, although unpopular with many gun owners and conservative politicians, supported by Australians. They approved of Howard's dedication and his desire to control the use of firearms within the country. This was ultimately the tipping point that prompted Australia's gun reform policy. Less than a month after the Port Arthur massacre, the National Firearms Agreement, or NFA, was drafted and a mandatory gun buyback program was instituted by the federal government. Gun owners surrendered an estimated 700,000 firearms, which was summarily destroyed.
John Howard was able to get multi-party support, and there was a huge difference in the gun laws between the states and territories. Some were really slack, and others were relatively tight. But they all had to be brought into line, and that was what was called the National Firearms Agreement. The National Firearms Agreement is not a law. It's basically a gentleman's agreement between all the state premiers and police ministers of all of the Australian jurisdictions who came together at a single meeting only 10 days after Port Arthur. 12 days after Port Arthur, everybody agreed that we would have uniform national gun laws right across Australia, and this would be done under what's called the National Firearms Agreement. But that's not a law. It's not binding. What then had to happen was that all of the states and territories had to go off, as they had promised, and bring all of their gun laws up to the same national standard. But what they did target was the mass shooting. Remember that the semi-automatic long gun, shotgun or rifle, was the weapon of choice for mass killers. And that was the gun that was targeted. Those were the guns that were seized, prohibited, and paid good money for. I must emphasize that the government gave a fair price for every one of those guns that they retrieved and destroyed. And by removing those specific firearms, the ones that were the weapon of choice for mass killers, Australia reduced its risk of mass shootings.
So, how have sentiments towards gun laws developed over the decades? A poll by The Age in Melbourne in 1996, the same year as Port Arthur, showed overwhelming support for banning automatic and semi-automatic firearms, registration of firearms, and for gun owners being required to store their guns at an armory or with the police. And in a 2016 survey by Essential Research, not much has changed. 85% of respondents thought that our laws were about right or should become tougher. But a growing percentage said that Australia's once strong stance against gun ownership is far less effective at preventing tragedies than it was 20 years ago. Pro-gun views are also picking up traction. Remember One Nation earlier this year counting donations from the US gun lobby?
One Nation could get $10 million.
Yep.
You'd pick up eight Senate seats.
That guarantees you balance of power. I mean, that would have the whole government on board.
Here in New South Wales, the main statutes that regulate allowable firearms and their registration are the Firearms Act 1996 and the Weapons Prohibition Act 1998. But perhaps the question that's been on everyone's mind is how difficult is it really to acquire a gun under these state laws?
It was extraordinarily easy to get a firearm before Port Arthur. Registration didn't exist in most territories.
And the short answer is, not as impossible as you would think. If you fill out the right paperwork, it is entirely possible to own a gun, provided that you have a genuine reason to own one. In Australia, applicants for a firearm license need to pass a background check, which considers criminal, mental health, physical addiction, domestic violence, residential, and other records. Yes, semi-automatic weapons are technically banned, but you can obtain a license to privately possess one in exceptional circumstances. While the checks are quite thorough, with a 28-day waiting period after purchase and being subject to random police inspections as to whether the weapon is securely stored and they're in the right mental state to own a gun, it is entirely possible to be a gun owner in Australia. So that then begs the question, how effective are our gun laws really? Professor Olp has introduced us to three pillars of gun control, arising from Asian and European empires in the early 1900s.
The first was gun owner licensing, in which you license the individual to operate an appliance, in this case a gun, exactly the same as you license an individual to drive a car. Then there was registration, which again is paralleled with cars. You register a car so that you're personally responsible for that vehicle. Well, registration with firearms is the same. The serial number for the gun is taken and you are personally responsible for each firearm in your possession. And then the third pillar of gun control was that it is a conditional privilege to own a firearm, that if you do something silly with a gun, then you can have that privilege taken away. Now, you'll notice that all three of those are absent in the United States. They didn't go the same way. They're almost the only country in the world that didn't go that way. And that is the cause of American exceptionalism when it comes to gun control. After the Port Arthur gun laws had been all enacted, the risk of an Australian dying by gunshot dropped by more than half, more than 50%. And it stayed there ever since, all these years later. After the National Firearms Agreement, all sorts of changes became apparent. When you register all firearms, you immediately make each person responsible for each firearm in their possession. And that slashed the number of gun thefts around the country. And the reason for that was that if your gun was stolen from your home or your milking shed, you now had a legal obligation to report it. And that meant that people became much more careful with their firearms. They didn't want their firearms turning up in some crime in the city. And so they started to report them, they started to lock them away much more securely. The laws insisted that the police come to your home and inspect your storage, your gun safety precautions, before you were even issued a firearm license. But also you had some very significant national changes to the law, and one of those was the prohibition of owning firearms for self-defense. It was no longer an excuse to own a firearm for self-defense. You had to have a much better reason for that. And that reason might include that you were a primary producer, in which case you need a gun for the farm, but only a certain type of gun. You didn't need a machine gun to shoot rabbits. If you lived in an urban area and you needed a firearm for, let's say, deer stalking or shooting feral pigs, you had to prove to the police that you actually had permission to shoot on a property where there were some feral pigs or some deer, and you couldn't just say that was your reason, and you would be denied a firearm unless you could prove that you had a really good reason for it. That greatly reduced the number of firearms being sold to wannabes who simply wanted to collect as many military-style firearms as they possibly could because they thought it was had something to do with manliness.
The reforms have also played a role in reducing domestic violence incidents.
Then you had all sorts of provisions which are designed to reduce the risk of firearms in domestic violence. Police were suddenly compelled to seize any firearms if there was an apprehended risk of violence, be it domestic violence or otherwise, in any situation. It suddenly became possible for police to call in to the gun registry through their computers and find out how many guns were at the house that they were about to approach. That made it possible not only to decide whether they needed backup, but also when they got inside, to decide how many guns they had to take away to make the house safe. And there have been many instances in the past where police have turned up, seized all the guns they could find, taken them away, and then a murder had happened, usually a domestic violence killing, with the gun they never found. Now, the registry made it possible for them to demand all of the guns. A domestic violence abuser wasn't able to hide one gun and use that to kill.
John Howard recently pointed out that after the 1996 National Firearms Agreement until 2018, Australia had experienced no mass shootings. He described it as ludicrous to suggest that gun control measures we introduced do not enjoy widespread support.
It's very common in Australia to think that we as a country have solved the problem of gun violence, that the National Firearms Agreement, which John Howard pushed through in 1996, has somehow solved the entire problem and we don't need to worry anymore. It's not a problem we need to spend much time on. But the opposite is true in some ways, because that attitude breeds complacency.
As the reforms post-1996 focused on mass shootings, there are serious oversights in other areas. For example, every state and territory actually allows children to possess firearms. As Professor Olpers told the ABC, depending on the state, 12-year-olds can have minor's licenses. And in Western Australia, there is no minimum age at all for children to be able to fire a gun at a gun range.
Not a single state or territory has complied in full with the National Firearms Agreement. And since that time, every single state and territory has in some way watered their laws downwards. So we have 20, 25, 24 years of slackening of the law in states. And that's because we have no federal gun laws to speak of. Each state and territory has its own gun laws, and they refuse to be dictated to by Canberra.
Many argue that the Australian system has become too relaxed with gun laws, failing to keep up with the technological advancements to firearms. 2 decades of political pressure have reduced restrictions and watered down the laws and undermined their original intent.
To guarantee public safety, you have to actually impose some regulation, some way of reducing the risk of firearm injury and death. The worldwide solution to all of this, I think, is increased awareness and not taking our existing gun laws for granted. We have to make sure that they work, enforce them, and just as we do with the road toll, with road safety, constantly try to reduce the number of people who are being killed either on the roads or by firearms. The police now realise the value of enforcing gun laws and being far more fair in the way they deal with gun owners. And by that I mean not automatically assuming that a person who has a firearm licence is a good bloke, but actually taking the assumption that they could be just as careless with their gun as they might be with their car.
But it's also important to remember the other and very important stakeholder in this debate, gun owners and primarily pro-gun people. Their stance can be summed up in 3 major areas. Firstly, on the topic of individual liberties. Secondly, that you need a gun for protective purposes. And thirdly, that a black market probably would arise as a result of banning such guns. On the question of individual liberties, there is a claim that gun law reform comes in spurts as an incredibly responsive measure to tragedy, often in the period after a mass shooting. Politicians understandably weight that heavily, but some argue that states overcompensate by pushing mitigative policies, not adequately considering the rights of gun owners who are safe and law-binding, and who ultimately fall in the massive majority.
I've read most of the gun laws of 350 jurisdictions around the world, and I can say that Australia has the most comprehensive, the most holistic approach to firearm injury prevention of any nation on earth.
The simple response is that it's still possible to get and use a gun for cases such as hunting pests, which for farmers and people in rural areas might be an absolute necessity. But it's important to understand the reasons why regulations will be involved in a process such as that, and why they have to exist.
We have, by and large, a pretty responsible attitude to firearm ownership in this country. But it needs to be, we need to be constantly vigilant, because there is a small minority who value their own convenience over that of public safety, and who keep insisting that the gun laws should be watered down and watered down and watered down a bit more.
The second question probably doesn't hold too much weight in Australia specifically.
Guns are no solution in self-defense. They are part of the problem. Statistically, the person most at risk from a firearm in the home is a person in the home.
The third is an argument that relates more to homicides, which are more common and cause more deaths than mass shootings. This is an alluring argument and correct to a certain extent, but it's hard to quantify or confirm. There's a bunch of issues we haven't had time to touch on, from why mass shootings happen, the role of the internet and alt-right forums, terrorism, or the law's relationship with mental health. There's an argument that gun law tightening is steps away from surveillance, then censorship, and so on. Some policies may be dangerous because the way that they are sold to the public is by demonizing people of particular identities. The way we respond to tragedies is as much intersectional as it is an issue in itself. And we need to remember the purpose of these laws: to save lives, prevent tragedies from occurring in the future.
This episode was created by the Sydney University Law Society and sponsored by Allens. Thanks to our host for this episode, Justin Lai, and Professor Philip Alpers for coming on the show. Our podcast production team is Alana Callis, Annie Chen, Chloe Khoury, Jonathan Shaw, Julia Saab, Justin Lai, Maddie Scott, and Vivian Lin. They've been instrumental in getting this podcast off the ground, so I want to say a really, really big thank you for all their hard work. The publications director for Souls this year is me, Jeffrey Koo. Hey, if you want to keep in touch with the events and activities that Souls is hosting this year, you can find us on Facebook. We are Sydney University Law Society. And we are also on Instagram. Just search SULS_Sydney. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.